The scripture reading is from the Old Testament, the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, and Psalm 63, verses 1 through 3. First from Ecclesiastes, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds for me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me, and all this my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. And now for Psalm 63. You, God, are my God. Earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you. My whole being longs for you in a dry and parched land where there is no water. I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory. Because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. This is God's word.
Good morning. Happy Mother's Day. This year marks the 40th anniversary of an iconic television commercial campaign launched by the Wendy's Corporation. It made famous the octogenarian Clara Peller, who peeled back the bun of a burger she had just been served, and then looking into the camera with a fierce face, asked the penetrating question, where's the beef? Some of us are still familiar with it. Not only did Wendy's sales go through the roof, but the question became a catchphrase that really became a cultural phenomena, because people started to ask it in all different spheres, trying to get at what is the substance of this thing. Now, we have just started a new series called Intersections, where life and faith meet. And today we're going to talk about life itself, because it's sort of like you and I are stuck between these two pieces of bread, between our birthday and, well, that other day. And we're trying to understand what is the substance of the thing. Is it possible for us to have real lasting purpose in life? It's not just a philosophical, speculative, or even spiritual question. Turns out for people who have real driving purpose in life, there are far better health outcomes. For instance, decreased level of stroke, heart attack, dementia, and even premature death. But the data shows that actually most of us don't have that sense of sustained purpose in our life. The Weill Cornell Medical School professor, Dhruv Kular, says this in a New York Times piece, only about a quarter of Americans strongly endorse having a clear sense of purpose and of what makes their lives meaningful. Nearly 40% either feel neutral or say they don't. And this is both a social and public health problem. Research increasingly suggests that purpose is important not only for a meaningful life, but also for a healthy life. So this modern existential problem with spiritual and health ramifications isn't really a new one, though, of course. It was being asked by the ancient sage in the book of Ecclesiastes about 1,000 years, roughly, before Jesus walked the face of the earth. It is a perspective that's really important for us to grapple with. if we're to understand where the beef, the essence, the substance of life is. And so we want to do that this morning, addressing this modern problem, looking at actually two different ancient perspectives. One from the book of Ecclesiastes, the other from the book of Psalms, the 63rd Psalm. One perspective under the sun, perspective in the sanctuary. So first of all, under the sun. Have you ever found yourself in a conversation with a religious person and you can't really relate because their language is so pious, so optimistically religious that you're sitting there going, it's like two ships passing in the night. Maybe they're being authentic, but it doesn't strike a chord in you as realistic to your own experience. You wouldn't feel that way most likely if you were having that conversation with the author of Ecclesiastes. Donning the cap of the teacher, the studied expert of life, this guy had a PhD in life itself. He opens his treatise by telling us he has absolutely nothing to say. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. You go, wow, that is a dark perspective. This guy needs an antidepressant quick. You know, a lot of us have been there. Some of us are there right now. And if nothing else, this makes the scriptures, I think, on something as important as what is life really about, so relatable. Because so many of us can say that rings true to some degree or another, at least at one point in my life. And what he said was, I have conducted an experiment looking at life itself as a laboratory to understand what this thing called life is really about. And he has done everything that he possibly could to get all the data he needed. So he tested pleasure. He said, I'm going to be the foremost hedonist on the planet. He invested his life thoroughly in his work and all these massive building projects. He developed a robust, thoroughly impressive portfolio. I mean, he was the king after all. And yet, at the end of the day, this colossal experiment on the essence of life, he concludes, was a massive failure. When I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had tried, toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. That word meaningless, it's used repeatedly throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, can be translated variously as meaningless, the way it is here in the NIV, vanity, the vanity of trying to build your life around the things in life. It can also be translated mist or vapor or breath. And he's saying, look, all of these things that I devoted myself to, projects, possessions, purchases, pleasure, the killer peas to a point, lead to this poignant conclusion that it's all like a breath. A chasing after the wind. And again, as the king, he had all the resources at his disposal. I've heard it said that the number one reason for small business failure is undercapitalization. That wasn't this guy's problem. He had all the resources. This project was fully funded. And yet he's going, time out. I heard a sermon years ago when I was a newer Christian by the great preacher Tony Evans. And I remember one of the things he said on this very point about the author of this book being the king. He said, look, if in life there could be found the answer to life, then this guy should be able to teach us about life because there was nothing in life that his life did not have. And yet for all of his accomplishments and acquisitions, at the end of the day, he said, it's a vapor. It's a breath. But I want you to notice, he didn't say everything is meaningless and leave it there. He said everything is meaningless under the sun. It's an expression that's only found in the book of Ecclesiastes, but it's found there 30 times. And it's not, I mean, sometimes people understand it to mean, oh, well, this is what it means to live in the world where God is absent, where he is not factored in. But this guy was a person of faith, however dry, however much he was struggling. So one of the things I really want us to appreciate from this passage in the book of Ecclesiastes, from this perspective of life under the sun, is that this is common to our human experience. Whether you describe yourself as a person of faith or not, whether you'd say that you are very convinced as a Christian, or maybe you just got a lot of questions, and frankly, right now you're deconstructing, you don't really know where things are. Life under the sun, it's where we all are, of course. And starting this time of year through about maybe early October in a place like Houston, it is quite the poignant image, isn't it? It should make us, therefore, empathetic with one another, less judgy. It also should encourage us, because it's part of our common vocabulary as human beings, to ask the question of ourselves: where is the beef? Where is the substance? Is this all there is? In one of the, of course, one of the greatest novels ever, The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky said, "The mystery of human existence lies not in just staying alive, but in finding something to live for." See, this is the existential crisis. It's the question that this first perspective from Ecclesiastes is posing to us, because it wants to leave us in tension so that we're asking that of ourselves. But that's just one perspective. Let's think about the second perspective. It's not just that we're living life under the sun, but there's this place that David describes as in the sanctuary. Now, Psalm 63 is just a fantastic poem, an ancient poem. As you may know, the book of Psalms, the Psalter, is actually a songbook. It was the worship manual, and at the same time, the theological, arguably the most theologically dense statement of faith in the Old Testament. It's because theology is, as they said, this sounds cliche, but I think it's so true. It is theology that's designed to be unto doxology. And you see this in David's experience as he sings about this. Now, the first thing we notice is that he also is living life under the sun. It is not easy. It is tough. He's composed it from the desert of Judah, where the sun unrelentingly beat down upon him. He was on the run, though we don't know exactly the experience that this is referencing in Psalm 63. But he's experimented in his life extensively, trying to find the substance of life from the things in life. And David's conclusion, like his sons, if Solomon indeed was the author of Ecclesiastes, and that's not actually known, then they both came to the same conclusion oftentimes, that there was a vanity, a lack of substance to those things. It left David feeling like someone in the desert, where his inner being resembled a wasteland, as he stated in the first verse, a dry and parched land where there is no water. That was literally the case in the desert of Judah, but he's saying, as in great poetry, there's levels of appreciation here. I'm really talking ultimately about what's going on in my own soul. It is a dry and parched land. But in this magnificent poem, he doesn't leave it there, life under the sun. He pivots. And the way he pivots, the outcome of that, we see in verse 5. It wasn't read for us, but listen to this experience. "I will be fully satisfied as with the richest of foods." There's the beef. there's the substance. How did he get there? Three things for us to notice about in the sanctuary, this perspective. First, what he was doing, his focus. It was not about himself primarily, but he was not divorced from it. Notice what he says in verse 1. You, God, are my God. Earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you. My whole body longs for you. It's actually the exact opposite of what you see in Ecclesiastes, where everything is built around this common thing. See if you understand or if you can catch what the common theme is. I built houses for myself. I amassed silver and gold for myself. I became greater by far than anyone. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. It was about the three most important people in his experience, me, myself, and I, over and over and over again. His life was consumed with that. And it turns out that when we build our life around ourselves, trying to find within our life the things that are going to make us full, it's bound to go bad on us. Harvard professor Arthur Brooks, who I think is one of the great voices, cultural voices today, in his book From Strength to Strength says, if you love things, you will strive to objectify yourself in terms of money, power, pleasure, prestige, idols, all. You will worship yourself, or at least a two-dimensional cutout of yourself. And actually, I think both are true, aren't they? That when we reduce our lives to these things that we, in a sense, are going into the sanctuary of the experiences of life to get the substance out of life, then having reduced our life to that, we actually reduce ourselves in the process. David is telling us purpose in life, substance of life, comes instead from centering our lives on God and doing everything we can to seek him. Now, two things to notice before we move on. One, that he was having to seek God meant this didn't come naturally. It's one of the things that flies under the radar, I think, for us oftentimes when we're reading the Bible. And again, you might talk to someone else, hear someone else talk about their faith, and you think, gosh, it just comes so easily for them. Why is it so difficult for me? It wasn't easy for David, but he was passionate. He said, this is going to be my determined focus. That meant there had to be an intentionality, that he was going to build rhythms into his life to adopt sort of a Lewis and Clark tenacity of seeking out the destination of who God is. So it doesn't come easy. The other thing to notice before we move on is how personal this experience was for him. Remember, he says, you, God, are my God. He doesn't say you're the God. You're this code of ethics that I've ascribed to. This doctrinal statement that I adhere to. See, he wasn't trying to get more religious, trying to put a moral band-aid over his life. He wanted God personally, intimately, in communion with him. That's the first and most important thing about discovering the essence or substance of life, because if we don't make that our focus, then we will be off course in this pursuit. So what did he do? His focus was to seek out God. Secondly, where did he go about seeking God? David gives to us a spiritual map as to how to go about doing this. He said in verse 2, I have seen you in the sanctuary, there it is, and beheld your power and your glory. The sanctuary in the Old Testament was this place. I mean, there's a sense in which, even back then, you could connect with God anywhere because he's the God of the heavens and the earth. But there was this special place where God had invested his presence. And if you could just get there, if you get in there, see, you could behold the character of who this grand being is, his glory and his power. And we talk a lot about that Hebrew word kavod for glory. It literally means substance. You want to know what the substance of life is, what the purpose of life is? David is saying it is in the sanctuary because that's where you get the glory of God. But one of the other things that we shouldn't miss about this is that implicit in saying, I've got to get into the sanctuary, is David wasn't just saying, I'm going to have my, you know, quiet time by myself in my special chair. And boy, this is, I love this. And this is really, really important. Because, oh God, you are my God. It is a very intimate, personal thing. But not to the exclusion of it being in the community of gathered worshipers. That's one of the things that's implicit whenever the sanctuary is mentioned, because there are things that happened here. There's a mystery to it, right? Someone told me about a podcast recently I listened to on the health benefits of saunas. I have not been interested in saunas previously. And you go, why? And I'm like, because I live in a sauna, you know? But it turns out there's a lot of data, apparently, don't take it from me, that over time, the accrued health benefits are substantial. There's a corollary there spiritually. And it doesn't feel like a sauna in here. It feels more like an icebox, right? But over time, because the problem is a lot of us are so addicted to immediate gratification that you go into, it doesn't have to be here, any church you might go to, and you go, oh, you know, the sermon was a snoozer, I didn't like the music, or people were rude to me, whatever it was, and you dip your feet in the water and you're back out again. But what you see in the scriptures, and I think this is so important, is that if you make it a discipline, if you develop rhythms in your life where you are more often than not there, not to check the religious box, not so that other people are going to think you're a good person of faith, but because you realize there's stuff spiritually that happens when we're together, that there's a sense in which it can transport us. I mean, what we'll do in a few moments in the Eucharist, the word sacrament, it's no mistake that it comes from the word that means mystery. There is a power and an otherworldly mystery to it that we desperately need. You say, preach it. Well, that's what I'm trying to do. While we're doing life under the sun, let's get ourselves regularly into the sanctuary, personally in times with the Lord, but in times like this as well together. So we can behold, we can begin to not only know intellectually about the glory and power of God, but so that those realities about who God is thrill us. That's the substance of life. Now, what is it, thirdly, we talked about what he was doing, seeking God, where he was doing it in the sanctuary, but what really drove him? What made all this possible for him? David tells us the outcome, and this is our desired outcome, I think, in life as well. Verse 3, because your love, talking to God, singing to God, because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. And that's a different word for, it's not the word kavod for glory. It could be translated, my lips will celebrate you. My lips will praise you. They will laud and magnify who you are. It's worship that doesn't feel so much like a discipline as it is just an instinctive delight because of who God is. See, you and I are built to be lovers. There's nothing that our souls crave as much as love and acceptance, right? And what David is saying here is a pretty radical concept. He's saying, I've experimented with all of life. I know a lot of pleasures, and yet I am willing to forsake all of them. I'm willing to forsake even life itself if it means living without your love. Your love, O Lord, is greater than life. And you might hear this and think, well, this certainly sounds like a pretty self-consumed orientation. Have you ever noticed a couple who's really in love and it sort of feels like they want you to know they're really in love? They're just PDA all over the place, and they become kind of a little bit of a cocoon, their relationship does. A true Christian relationship with God through Christ doesn't actually do that. The closer and more intimately you become, the more His love means to you, it actually opens us up so that we want to become an instrument of love to other people. That's why the first and greatest commandment, loving God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, is like Jesus said, the other great commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. The two work together symbiotically. So much so that Mother Teresa said, I am a pencil in the hand of God who's sending a love letter to the world. Now, all of this at one level makes so much sense, right? But at another level, when you think about David, it doesn't make sense. How is he seeking after God? How is he trying to do everything and run after God when he should be, given who he was, running away from God? I mean, the Bible talks more, we have more information about David than any other human being. And there's some really beautiful moments, like in this song. We looked at 1 Chronicles 29 a couple of weeks ago, another high watermark for David. But let's be honest, David had a pretty checkered past. And yet he's seeking after God so he can get into the sanctuary and behold God's glory and power. Why doesn't that glory and power completely consume him in judgment, given his past? It's because of that word love. And as you probably know, the Bible has a lot of different words that can be translated love. This is that Old Testament word, it's chesed, and it's not an ephemeral feeling, it's an eternal commitment of compassion by God, downloading His love into our life. It's the love that runs after us so we can run after God. And it's the key to understanding how David could be so bold. And yet even David didn't have nearly the clarity that you and I do, because it was 1,000 years later when David's greatest descendant, Jesus, left the world of glory and power so that he could live under the sun amongst us in our shoes. And every single day of his life under the sun, Jesus lived a perfectly purpose-filled life. And just like you and me, he thirsted. But unlike you and me, when he spread out his arms on the cross and he said those epic words that have echoed through the ages, I am thirsty, he meant much more than a physical thirst. There was a deep metaphysical component. Jesus thirsted existentially, you might say, so you and I might find our deepest satisfaction in the substance of who He is. Listen, life under the sun can be really brutal. And there are going to be many points in your life and mine where even if you don't utter it, you're thinking, this just feels meaningless. I don't see how all this fits together. And when you feel that way, can I just encourage you to be kind to yourself. Don't be judgy to yourself, and certainly not to others, because it is the human experience under the sun. But also, let's remember, that's just one perspective. We must not leave it there. We actually can pivot to this other perspective, to seek after God, the one in whom is found substance, to get into the sanctuary so we can actually behold the glory and the power that has the capacity to sustain us and fill us with his substance, so that our heart and their affections are kindled with deep love for him, so that the desired outcome is that you and I can say together with David, because your love, O Lord, is better than life itself, my lips will glorify you. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the realism of the Bible, that in places like the book of Ecclesiastes and Psalm 63, it truly does speak to our condition. I pray, Father, that for those who are feeling particularly under the sun today, that you would give them the capacity by your grace to lead them into the sanctuary. For that hesed love that runs after us, that we might therefore have the driving capacity to seek you, to behold your power and glory, and to declare that your love is better than life. Amen.